we're taking a look at the culinary history of the Midwest with a chef who decided to explore her family's culinary history. She wanted to find out how she became the food lover she is today, and she decided to delve into the lives of her ancestors.
She's here to share what she discovered and to share some of her favorite family recipes. Kathleen Flynn is the author of several books. Her latest is called Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir of food and love from an American Midwest family. Kathleen, welcome back to Wisconsin Public Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So how big of a role did food play when you looked at your family's history?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I actually started this whole book because I wanted to recreate my dad's chicken and dumplings recipe. And, you know, it was something his anniversary of his passing about 30 years ago, it had come up in 2010. And so I asked my mom, hey, do you have that recipe anywhere at all? And she got a box down from her closet, and in the box were there were recipes, but there were also all these stories that she had written about their years on our farm, this 10-acre farm in central Michigan, and stories about them leaving everything in the late 1950s when they drove across Route 66 to go out to San Francisco to work in my Irish uncle's Italian restaurant, and stories about my father growing up in abject poverty during the Great Depression. And when I went through these stories, and I had never seen them before, my mom had been scrolling away for all this time, I was really struck by how much in every single story there was this theme of food. And it all, even stories going back to my great-great-grandmother, Anna Erickson Monk, who arrived in America in 1890 with a single suitcase. And she couldn't speak English very well, but she found out that cooks made more money than housemaids. So she told everybody, I'm a cook, yeah. And she settled in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan in the Newberry area. And from then on, I found out when I did the research that in every generation, people in my family worked as cooks, or cooking was their passion. And I was struck by that because it was something I hadn't realized until I really started to kind of root around in my past.
And it sounds as though sometimes food stood in for communication in your family. It was a way that you expressed love. And speaking of love, I love the quote that you have from your grandmother in the front of your book. She says, "I don't have to tell you that I love you. I fed you pancakes."
Exactly. And I think that is, you know, so apt, really, because if you think about, I'm sure my family was not unusual. And in fact, I think when I compiled this whole story, and yeah, it's the story of my family, but I think that many people, particularly in the Midwest, will really see sort of this immigrant story of people coming from different, coming from different parts of the world, marrying into, other kind of ethnic backgrounds, and then sort of the melange that happens with all their food. But I think one thing that was very common, when I was a kid, and definitely in the generations before me, is that, some big life event happened, say there was a death or a birth or something else. I mean, the very first thing people did was say, well, let's take them over some food, so that they don't have to worry about feeding themselves. And it was a way to really connect and to nourish with people. And I still do that today. I know that there's still a lot of people who follow that tradition. And I think that food often is a way to really communicate and say something when you sometimes don't know what else to say.
Today, a lot of people, not a lot of people, but some people are fearful about food, about cooking, that you really have to know what you're doing to even attempt to cook something in the kitchen. Your parents, on the other hand, just took off to California to help run a pizza parlor. They didn't know anything about pizza. How did they end up there?
My uncle Clyde, who is older than my dad, it's a little confusing exactly how he ended up with this Italian restaurant. His partner was this murky character who I think may have had some sort of dodgy connections. He was actually Italian and then was sort of out of the picture pretty early on. But he owned this Italian restaurant, and he could have hired somebody locally, but he was very close to his family, and he took care of his younger brothers and sisters. And so so he called up my dad because he knew that there was a big recession going on in the late 1950s. And my parents dropped everything, and they drove across Route 66, ended up in the Mission District, and they had only had pizza in an actual restaurant one time, and it was at Shakey's Pizza in Lansing, which is still there. And other than that, they had tried the newfangled Chef Boyardee package, you know, where you get the little can and you get the dough and everything, and they tried that once or twice, and that was it. That was, but they were really fearless, and I think that it was very much a sign of the generation that they came from. They were part of what's known as the Silent Generation. They were the children of the Great Depression. And so my father grew up thinking that it was really normal that everybody went to bed really hungry at night. And I think when you come from a place where you're just happy to have enough to eat, you know, it really can, I think it really offered them a great sense of sort of optimism, like everything else is up from here, you know. And I think it made them very resilient individuals. And as a result, I think as their children, they taught us the same thing.
Well, your parents eventually settled at a farm in Michigan. How did living on that farm, close to the land, close to food production, how did that influence you and your makings as a chef?
You know, it's funny. When I was a little girl, and, you know, I really wanted Wonder Bread and, like, bologna sandwiches and sugar cereal, because it was all the stuff I couldn't get, you know? I mean, we always want what we can't have. And then when we moved from the farm, all I wanted, and today, all I want are the flavors of the farm. I want really wonderful tomatoes that, you know, you can pick, you can smell them before you even pick them up, or to sit in a strawberry patch and just eat strawberries right from the vine and have the homemade bread and that kind of hearty, very simple food that my parents, you know, grew up on and ultimately taught us. I mean, the whole thing started because one day I was lonely for my father and I really wanted his chicken and biscuits. And still to this day, when I, you know, if I feel like I need a pick-me-up, I'll do something like make my Uncle Charles or my Uncle Clarence's cornflake crusted chicken, because there's something that always haunts you, I think, about the flavor of your childhood.
Did you ever find your dad's recipe for those chicken and dumplings?
No, we never did. So I decided to work on, and in the book I have my mother's chicken and biscuits recipe, actually. And it's pretty good. I think we've replicated her recipe pretty well. But the dumplings have always eluded me. My dad's dumpling recipe, something about his dumplings. So
yeah, sometimes
I'm still working on that.
Sometimes they don't write them down. Sometimes they're so much a part of you that you can never, you know, find them in writing anywhere. That's one of the things about being a family cook.
Yeah, it's really, that's so true. My grandfather was actually, my maternal grandfather, was a cook in the Army during World War One. It actually turned out he became a cook because he had been busted for bootlegging as a teenager and had spent time in a county jail, and so he wasn't eligible to fight. So they transferred him to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, where he learned to make chili and all kinds of stuff and was a lifelong cook. I mean, just loved to cook. But in my family, he was the one who made all the jams and the jellies, because he kind of considered it sort of an art, you know. And my mom and I had tried over the years to try to replicate her favorite, which was blueberry jam, and never was quite there. So then we were in Asheville, North Carolina, and we sat down at this place called the Tupelo Honey Cafe, and they brought us some blueberry jam, and my mother took a bite. She put it on a biscuit, took a bite, and she started to cry. She was just overwhelmed, and I said, "Mom, what is it?" She said, "This tastes just like my dad's."
Oh,
and
wow.
That it was a recipe, and they had a cookbook for sale, and that recipe was in it, and we got it, and we made it, and we figured out what we were doing wrong is we were always adding too much sugar. And so, but that small bite, you know, she just was so flooded with all these memories, and like, just this love, you know, for her father and the times that she would spend in the kitchen with him making jam.
Yeah, food can be that direct line right to the memory, can't it?
Definitely.
I know that your book, it's special because it's not just a memoir. It shares some of these recipes. And one of these very special recipes in your family is cinnamon rolls, especially birthday cinnamon rolls. Mm-hmm. What's so special about those to your family?
Well, when we were living on the farm, my parents had bought into, they became partners in a business with his brothers. It was actually aluminum siding, very, you know, hot thing in the 60s. And it just happened that the business folded, and they owed a great deal of money to friends and family who had lent it to them, and also a couple banks who had lent them the money to help start that business. And so my father could have declared bankruptcy, but he didn't want to leave the people who had trusted him often just on his word. So my parents decided they would pay everybody back. They went on a plan. They were going to do it within 7 years. And as a result, we really had no money. We lived, like, we were on the farm. Fortunately, we never had a problem eating because we had this big farm and mom and Ken, and we raised chickens, and my dad always got a deer. But that meant that we didn't really get much in the way of, say, birthday presents, for example. And so instead of some expensive gift, my mother would let us each order whatever we wanted for our birthdays, so at lunch or dinner. And we'd spend a lot of time thinking about it. Like, mine was always like fried chicken and mashed potatoes and stuff like that. And but one thing we always wanted was cinnamon rolls. And the ones that my grandmother made required two risings, so they took kind of a long time. My mom didn't do them regularly. But, you know, because she felt like, wow, you know, her kids kind of were missing out on, you know, new bikes or, you know, going on family vacations and stuff other than, you know, going fishing, she would get up at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the morning so that she could make these cinnamon rolls for us on our birthdays before we went to school.
That's love, double rye cinnamon rolls. Well, we're talking right now to chef and author Kathleen Flynn about her new memoir. It's called Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good.
We want to hear about your family recipes. What dishes are famous in your family, and what's the one thing you always have at holiday meals or birthdays? You can call in and share your recipes and memories at 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org.
We're picking up our conversation with Kathleen Flynn about her new memoir about her family's culinary history.
And we're taking your calls. What one recipe says it all about your family? How has your family's history been shaped by food and the way that food tastes? Call in with your recipes and your memories at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send an email at talk@wpr.org.
And we're going to go now to Kathleen, joining us in Menominee. Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi, thank you.
What is your food memory?
Well, when I was very little, my grandmother that lived on northern Michigan up on the UP had raspberry patches. And she made jam, and we also just ate from them. But that only goes up until I was 7 years old, maybe. And we moved further away and didn't come home as often. And she passed away when I was 7 or 8. And then when we came home, Grandpa had taken away the berry patch years and years and years later. And I'm a grown woman with a baby, and I'm visiting a friend who I had just met. And, oh, she says, here are some raspberries on my counter. We just picked them this morning. I don't know, how nice. And I took one bite, and the tears, like Kathleen mentioned when her mother ate the blueberry jam, and the memory of my grandmother came flooding back. It was just lovely. It was just lovely.
That's a beautiful memory, fresh raspberries. And it's interesting that two similar experiences there, that there's just sort of this hotline between the mind and the emotion and food, which I guess explains why, Kathleen, your family was so deeply wound up between food and memory and love. Do you think that's unusual, or do you think this is something that's true with a lot of families?
I think it's true with a lot of families. I mean, I think that one of the things that, you know, when I was newly married to my husband, and one of the things I wanted to do is to make the dishes that he remembered from his childhood. Unfortunately, his mom made a lot of things out of boxes. And so one thing that he loved was something called Noodles Romanoff, which had, you know, was discontinued in 1994. And I actually searched and tried to remake that for him because I wanted, you know, to give him something, this flavor and this experience that, you know, he missed because his, you know, his late mother used to make it for him. And the other thing he loves and he'll still do is he'll use his mom's mixer. It's from 1962. It still works, the Hamilton Beach. And he'll make a cake and make the same kind of cake that he made with his mom's. And when he does that and that process of making it and, you know, and dipping and licking the bowl and making it into a cake, and I don't even really like cake, big cake eater, but I love it when he does that, and I want to share that with him because I think that that kind of experience is just a pure expression of love.
Now that we live in the age of computers and, you know, you can just search for something on Epicurious or just on the internet and we don't often write down what we pull up or tweak, are we losing something when we don't leave a paper trail that has our, you know, our chocolatey fingerprints on it?
You know, that's really interesting. I think actually we're missing out on the fact that a lot of people don't cook. I mean, I think sometimes some of these recipes are getting lost with a generation that, you know, kind of does take out or thinks cooking is too messy or, you know, they don't feel confident in the kitchen. I did my second book was all about that. I did a whole project trying to understand what holds people back from cooking. And, you know, one thing that people will make, even if they don't like to cook, is they'll often make, like, the holiday recipes. It's actually those are the ones that are probably the most likely to persevere. But if you have a generation and maybe a second one and they don't cook, those recipes, I fear, really do get lost. One positive thing about the internet and all of these recipe sites is that a lot of them allow you to collect them together. Where, you know, even my grandmother, she had a recipe box, and man, they were all over the place. And so, you know, and I think it allows people to formalize and have like the right quantities and that sort of stuff that you don't have when you're just writing it down.
I want to thank Kathleen for that call, and we're going to go next to Tom in Greenfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I was going to just make a comment about the topic you were just speaking of, as far as lost recipes. I come from the same kind of Midwestern background where food was important and cooking and farm families, and those would be families of my great-grandparents, actually. And my great-grandmother's recipes were all written down and in a file box similar to what was just described, unorganized though it may be. But her recipes were like one blue bowl of flour, one red cup of sugar, one green spoon of vanilla. And those recipes were not lost to my family because my mother actually had the foresight to go into my great-grandmother's kitchen before they broke up housekeeping and moved into a retirement home and measure the bread bowl and the blue cup and the green spoon and find out exactly how much each of those measures were. And we still now have some of those same recipes that have been transposed into more standard units of measure, I guess you would say. I'm so grateful. My mom's since passed, but I'm so grateful to her for that because I can still make my great-grandmother's blueberry muffins if I want.
Oh, that's a fantastic story. And do you also, Tom, still have the red bowls and the blue cups and all that?
No, we do not. No. But we do know what their values were.
Oh, well, that's...
That was the most important thing as far as not losing that connection to the food. And my wife and I both come from similar families of people who still do cook. And thankfully, our children do, too. So I don't think we're totally lost on generations that don't cook because I think that's an important skill and something that's really important to pass on to our children as well.
Great. Thanks for that story, Tom. Kathleen, what do you think?
Oh, I love it. My grandmother, that's so funny. I laughed when he said that because my grandmother's recipes had very similar notation. And my grandfather, who rarely wrote anything down, he actually said a fistful of this or whatever. And she had a lot of pinching and, you know, whatever and stuff like that. And my grandfather was 6'4". I mean, he was a big guy. I mean,
his fistful
is quite different than my fistful, so I don't know that I'll ever know what that is. But she also would say, go pick the largest chicken out of the pen. That was one of her other recipes, which is, you know, I don't even know where to go with that. So, but I love it. That's really great. And I think it really does show that, you know, she was measuring with what she cooked with every day. And I think that is not as uncommon as you might think, because when you look back at older recipes, particularly going back in like the 1800s, there's a lot of that, because there wasn't as much, there might have been in, you know, kind of more professional kitchens, but homemakers, you know, there wasn't necessarily a standard cup or, you know, a standard tablespoon. Even today, tablespoons are different in the United States than they are in the United Kingdom. So there are, you know, flexible variations everywhere, which fortunately in cooking a lot of times doesn't make as much of a difference, but in baking, everything can go wrong.
Well, let's make time for this one last call. Sarah from Madison, you've got about 30 seconds. Sorry to rush you, but what is your food memory?
My food memory from my grandmother is, well, she cooked all the time, but the one thing that stands out is she would make coconut cream pie, and she would make the custard homemade. And anytime I smell that, it just brings me to tears. But it also thrills me to my core. So I'm so excited about this program, and I think it's important for people to cook and to keep those recipes alive, because it's, I don't know, it's just, it's really important, and it's healthier.
Right. Well, thank you so much. Coconut cream pie for Sarah brings her to tears, makes her emotional. And if you're looking back, Kathleen, is there one iconic recipe that you have to have, you know, in your life?
Yeah, I actually would say, my grandmother's lemon meringue pie. That's funny, she just said that about a pie, too. When my grandfather was very ill toward the end of his life, he didn't have much of an appetite for anything. The only thing that he wanted was lemon meringue pie. And so every day for 4 months, my grandmother made him a fresh lemon meringue pie every single morning.
Oh, that's beautiful. And we have to leave it there, Kathleen. It's been really fun to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
That was Kathleen Flynn, author of Burnt Toast Makes You Sing Good, a memoir of food and love from an American Midwest family. She's also the author of The Sharper Your Knife, The Less You Cry.